This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Sometimes what everybody thinks is going to happen is not what happens. And that, as they say in sports, is why you play the game. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday today, the 5th day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. And I will tell you what, you can talk black swans until the cows come home. Those completely unexpected events, often rationalized after the fact. There was not anybody who saw this morning's May unemployment report coming. Guesses were for maybe 10 million jobs having been disappeared last month. Instead, we got 2.5 million added back and the unemployment rate went down. Now, everything is obviously not labor market sunshine and light, but today, while surprising, was progress. We asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to do some forensics for us.
Let's start with this guy, Adam Ruffalo. He's 34, a dental office assistant in Austin, Texas.
At the beginning of the third week of March, they let us know that just due to COVID-19, we'd be closing the office.
Ruffalo got on unemployment. Then in mid-May, when Texas started reopening, he was called back.
It's great. You know, I much prefer the work than be sitting around somewhere not doing anything.
Now, multiply Adam Ruffalo by about 2.5 million, and that's how you get a massive job increase in May with the pandemic still raging. University of Michigan economist Betsy Stevenson says dentistry is actually a perfect microcosm of how service jobs are returning. It's a business where people have to be face-to-face or mouth-to-sharp, shiny dental instrument.
The economy started to open up, people went back to the dentist. So dentist offices accounted for a full 10% of the jobs gained last month.
But still, about 30% of people who worked at dentists' offices before the pandemic so far haven't been called back. Stevenson says consumers are still afraid of getting sick and spending their money. So dentists,
they are still not needing all their workers because fear and loss of income is holding back demand.
More than half the jobs that returned in May were at bars, restaurants, casinos, and the like. Joe Bruswellis at RSM Consulting saw the turnaround in real-time consumer activity.
Stores opening, TSA data, and road congestion, all of which clearly implied the worst was behind us, and a very modest recovery had started.
But he says it could be years before people go back to eating out and traveling like they used to, and all those workers have jobs again. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
One more thing coming out of Mitchell's story. For all the good there was in this report, it has to be pointed out that the black unemployment rate actually went up in May 16.7% to 16.8%. For a little context on why that is the reality in this economy historically and present day, I refer you once again to Mitchell Hartman. He has been burning the candle at both ends. His story from the Marketplace Morning Report this morning about black unemployment, lots of great context, is at marketplace.org. Okay, so back to the May jobs numbers and one possible reason they overperformed. Here's Marketplace's Justin Ho and the Paycheck Protection Program.
When Randy George received the PPP loan for the Vermont restaurant he runs, he knew he couldn't afford to pay it back. So George worked quickly to meet the loan's forgiveness requirements.
We put all of our full-time people that had been furloughed back on our payroll.
This is the first jobs report amid the pandemic that's reflected decisions like this, says economist Ernie Tedeschi at Evercore ISI.
Even though the CARES Act was passed in late March, it took time to get those programs set up and to get money out the door.
The Labor Department doesn't specify whether PPP loans are the reason jobs rose in May. But Tedeschi says there are clues. Leisure and hospitality businesses saw the most job gains. And that's a sector that's relied heavily on PPP loans.
It could be that, you know, restaurants who were hardest hit before are using those loans exactly as intended, which is to retain employees to pay them.
Tedeschi says other factors could be propping up job gains too, like people spending more as businesses reopen. Harvard economist Jason Furman says ideally, PPP loans should not be the only reason businesses are hiring people. After all, the PPP program won't last forever.
And as soon as the PPP expires, you know, they'll lose jobs.
Furman says for job gains to last, businesses need consumer demand to return as the economy reopens. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, I mean, what's supposed to happen when the economy shows strength actually happened, for a change. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, so a pause now for the What the Heck Happened This Week portion of this program. Heather Long is with The Washington Post. David Gura is with MSNBC. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Heather, let me start with you and ask you to synthesize basically those two spots. Mitchell on jobs, good news. Justin talking about the PPP, it's going to expire. Do you believe we have hit the bottom? Can we look forward strongly now, as it were?
Well, there's a lot of evidence that we have hit the bottom and we're starting a very, very slow recovery. So it's sort of that good news, bad news. Yeah, it's good news that it probably won't get any worse from here. But even today, when we see these job numbers, you know, we lost close to over 20 million jobs. Today, we found out we gained back 2.5. You do the math. It's good, but not great.
David Gura, let me refer you to comments from Stephen Moore, an economic advisor to the president of the United States, who basically said, yeah, we're not getting any more stimulus out of this White House. What do you think of that?
Yeah, curious thing. And I just wonder how serious a conversation there's going to be about more stimulus going forward here. The president, after this, took to the Rose Garden once again to crow about these numbers. And he said, we'll be asking for additional stimulus money. His words. We don't know what that means yet. The White House hasn't really articulated that. We know the House has passed this $3.5 trillion bill, which Senate Republicans say is dead on arrival, reporting today that the White House might be amenable to $1 trillion. But I think what this does is buys the White House and Senate Republicans time, at least as they see it. And having lived in Washington, I know how this works. Discussions are going to continue, and I don't know when the rubber is going to meet the road. And now there's talk of, you know, real substantive conversations about this happening in July. If you are not a Senate Republican or a member of this administration, if you're a liberal Democrat who thinks there needs to be more stimulus now, folks are going to grow impatient. There's a sense in that camp that you got to move quickly now. There's a need for more stimulus now. There's a need for more expansive stimulus now. So we're going to have what we have so much of in Washington these days, which is just real disagreement on a pretty fundamental issue.
Heather, it was alluded to in those two news spots, and you alluded to it a little bit. I mean, there is a deadline here for when this assistance goes away and people stop being able to be paid with a little help from the government.
I'm very worried about August. That's August 1st is when those unemployment and the extra $600 goes away. And we're still going to have millions of people who aren't able to come back to work because their business isn't fully opened. And at the same time, those PPP loans that were such a help in May are going to expire. And if the restaurant is only 50% open, guess what? They're not going to need all those employees going forward. The other clear thing from the jobs report today is while there were gains in restaurants and stores coming with some workers coming back, government jobs fell by over half a million. And in particular, education jobs, teachers, declined by over 300,000. So there's a huge need. Economists pretty much everywhere except the White House agree we need to give some relief to state and local governments, or we're going to see some really painful cuts this summer and fall.
Which gets us, David Gura, to the second order effects. I don't want to get all Rumsfeldian here, but there are some known unknowns coming up, right? How bad it's going to be.
Yeah, this has been the issue from the very beginning here. I'm sure Heather's had the same experience as I, talking to economists about how they forecast in this climate, how they try to make sense of the recession that we're in. And to a T, each has said, this is uncharted territory. This is unprecedented. There's no historical analog for what we're dealing with here. And so I think that's like what we saw laid out today in these numbers. I think a lot of those economists quite humbly would say, know this wasn't in line with our forecast, but we recognize that our forecasts were what they were. We're again kind of fumbling through all of this. So, yeah, I mean, I think to go back to your first question to Heather, there is a sense that we've hit the bottom here, but relativism is key. You know, being in the hole that we're in, there's a long way to climb out of this. And, you know, whether it's how long the stimulus lasts or what happens when that stimulus runs out or those expanded employment benefits that the folks have been getting, there are a lot of open questions here. And there is a tendency on the part of the administration toward haste. Things look good in the moment. Let's make hay while the sun's out. You say, things could change really dramatically here over the course of the summer. And as those variables come into play, it could have a really dramatic effect on, yes, what we've seen come to pass in this jobs report, but just also the labor market more generally.
I had a guy say to me 10 years ago, actually 12 years ago now in 2008, we're just going to bump along the muddy bottom for a while, right? Which is a little bit what it feels like. David Gura at MSNBC, Heather Long at The Washington Post. Thanks, you two.
Thank
you. Have a good weekend.
At the heart of the protests we have been seeing this week are some economic realities that can't be ignored. White families have 10 times more wealth than black families do. The gap in home ownership between black and white families is the widest it's been in this economy in 50 years. In Minneapolis, black families are about a third as likely to own a home as white families are. So our documentary podcast, The Uncertain Hour, has been talking to people about some of the reasons why. Here's Marketplace's Caitlin Ash.
I talked recently with a woman named Vanessa Bulness.
I live in Oakland, California. I've been a resident since 1986.
She would normally be teaching preschool right now, but the preschool where she works is closed. She's on furlough, but she still owes rent, about $2,600 a month.
What percentage of your income would you say your rent takes up?
About 70%.
Wow, 70%.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, Vanessa used to own her own home, but she lost it to foreclosure in the aftermath of the last economic crisis, the Great Recession.
My husband had a massive stroke in 2008, and for 4 years, we tried to get a modification to lower our monthly mortgage payment, but we were unsuccessful, and then that's how I became a tenant here at the property that we're living in now.
In the 8 years she's been a renter, she's had four landlords.
It went from Waypoint Homes to Colony Starwood Homes to Starwood Homes and Blackstone, and now is Invitation Homes.
I wanted to understand why so many people are in Vanessa's position these days, paying rent to huge corporations instead of mom-and-pop landlords, and why so many people, especially Black people and people of color, are renting instead of owning their home. So I talked to Aaron Glantz. He's a senior reporter at Reveal and the author of a book with a very long title, Homewreckers: How a Gang of Wall Street Kingpins, Hedge Fund Magnates, Crooked Banks, and Vulture Capitalists Suckered Millions Out of Their Homes and Demolished the American Dream. He says one important thing to understand happened during the Great Recession.
It's 2008, and the economy is falling apart. Homes are no longer worth as much as they were before, and people are out of work.
Banks are foreclosing on thousands and thousands of homes.
And so what ends up happening is that investors, vulture capitalists, come in and start buying not one house or two houses as fixer-uppers, but thousands of houses all at once.
So as you point out in your book, communities of color were hit disproportionately hard by the housing crisis, lost much of their wealth, and then they lost out on the recovery. Why?
We have a history of institutional racism in this country that continues today. We looked at 31 million mortgage records, and we found dozens of cities across the country where people of color were far more likely to be turned down for a loan, even when they made the same amount of money, tried to take out the same size loan, and buy in the same neighborhood as their white counterparts. Banks treated them differently. So they were far more likely to rent from one of these Wall Street landlords, which would keep raising the rent to pay off their rising debt.
Just like Vanessa, the renter in Oakland, Aaron says an investor bought the house she's now renting for $174,000 in 2012.
Now, today, according to Zillow, it's worth more than $700,000. So who got the benefit of that price appreciation over the time? It could have been Vanessa. She's been making payments all this time, right? It's just that she doesn't get any equity from any of those payments. It's all gone to these corporate landlords.
And so Vanessa and many others entered the pandemic a renter with a smaller safety net. I'm Caitlin Esch for Marketplace.
The Uncertain Hours new season, it's called A History of Now, is downloadable at the app of your choice. Coming up.
They're on a journey right now.
Aren't we all, though? First, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go on a Friday. Dow Industrials up 829 points, 3.1%, 27,110. The NASDAQ picked up 198 points, just over 2%, 98.14, just shy of its all-time high. The S&P 500 added 81 points, 2.6%, 31.93. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow up 6.8%, the NASDAQ up 3.4%. S&P 500 up 4.9%. Americans pretty much stopped going for regular medical visits during the lockdown, especially hospitals. Coming back, though, according to research by brokerage firm Jefferies, shares in Tenet Healthcare picked up 15.3%. HCA Healthcare added just over 8% today. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 0.88%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We're going to go back to this morning's jobs report for just a minute here. And remember, it's data for May from this morning. Last month, when the April report came out, we had called Martha Gimbel. She's the manager of economic research at Schmidt Futures. And we'd asked her to explain this thing in the jobs numbers called the diffusion index.
The diffusion index basically measures how widespread job losses or gains are.
It goes from 0 to 100. Closer to 0 means more industries lost jobs. Closer to 100 means more industries added jobs. In April, it was 4.8, meaning really only a handful of industries had managed to add jobs in the month of April. So yesterday, and let's get the timestamp in here.
It is Thursday, June 4th at 10:33 a.m. Eastern.
We asked Martha Gimbel what she thought the number for May would be.
So I'm expecting it to stay pretty low.
How low exactly?
Forecasting, particularly in a pandemic, is just a fool's game. So I'm going to stick with single digits, somewhere between like 5 and 10.
You know we called her back this morning, right?
I think I said the word what about 20 times in a row. The number was obviously a shock.
The diffusion index, the measure of how widespread job gains and losses are, that she was guessing would be around 5 or 10?
It spiked up to 64.
Which means more industries gained jobs than lost them. Education, construction, retail, and hospitality. Also, by the way, the April diffusion index that was 4.8 got revised down to 3.9.
Which reflected the fact that job loss was worse in April than we thought. All of this is really just to say that economists really have no idea what's going on right now.
Economists and everybody else. Martha Gimbel at Schmidt Futures, thanks for being such a good sport for us. We are totally, by the way, calling her up next month. Over the past, 6 or 7 years, when I have had a thing I wanted to talk about movies and the culture of this economy, we have called Wesley Morris at the New York Times. It is not movies today, though, but videos and this moment that he has been writing about this week, so we called him up this morning. Wesley Morris, it has been a very long time.
I know. Hi.
Hi.
I don't know why I'm so happy to talk to you. This is my excitement is only for you. It is not for anything else having to do with anything happening in this country right now.
I completely appreciate that, and I'm flattered. But I thought the other day to myself as I was watching and listening and reading the news, I got to talk to Wesley. And then you wrote this thing the other day that made me say, we got to get him on the radio now. I want you to tell me about Patti LaBelle.
Okay, so Patti LaBelle. I was home last week on a Sunday doing my normal Sunday stuff. I'm standing there listening. I've been listening to all the Patti LaBelle records just because I do that from time to time. I just go through some writer or artist or singer or filmmaker stuff and just like experience it all. Anyway, I'm there and the end of, you know, I think her seventh album is called Patti, and the last song is a live cover of If You Don't Know Me By Now. And she creates her own section of this song where she is just telling this live audience about whether to leave this man. And there's something about the way she has phrased it. You are allowed to hear her talking about somebody bigger than any one person. And I just was, there was something about watching that George Floyd video and, you know, having almost a decade of this kind of information, this visual information. And it just hit me. Like, this has been going on for the entire history of this country. Some version of this. And it persists. And the chorus of the song is, if you don't know me by now, you will never, never, never know me.
Yeah.
It just sounded like the most profound, deep, eternal assertion of frustration that I had ever heard in that moment.
There was a line in this piece that you wrote, which I, as I always do with your pieces, I recommend it to everybody. And you said this. This country manufactures only one product powerful enough to interrupt the greatest health and economic crisis it has probably ever faced.
Racism. It is, I think that one of the things that's been frustrating for a lot of people is that people, this is new to people. This George Floyd video, I mean, I have all kinds of theories as to why it's this, but people are being passed through something. I'm thinking mostly of white people, and especially given who I'm seeing in these protests. They're on a journey right now, and they're on a journey to catch up with where lots of other people in this country have been the whole time. And so, it's just been fast. Anyway, ask your question. Sorry.
Well, no, look, I want to know if you think the journey this time is different. Because if the journey this time isn't different, then does it? Okay, tell me more.
I have seen, I don't know what state this was in. I just heard this on the radio the other day. It was a bunch of, was introduced as a group of young white people standing up against racism and injustice. And they were essentially saying amongst themselves, the protest chant, I can't breathe. And the way the protest chant typically goes is, I can't, and then the rest of, you know, one person leads it. It's a call and response. I can't, and then the crowd will respond, breathe. And they weren't doing it the way it's typically done, is what I'll say. And it was just like, they have gotten the memo, and they're doing it. And it's not like, I don't mean get the memo like they have to do it. I mean, they have been moved to do this, because my point is, this wasn't happening when Eric Garner died. This didn't happen in Ferguson.
So locate this for me culturally, right? Do you think this moment passes, or does it endure?
That's the question. I think that I felt this way before we were in the streets. Although, to be clear, I'm not in the protests. I don't want to get sick. I support the protests. I've been standing on the sidelines watching. But I think that we have seen too much between the virus and the protests against these injustices against Black people. I really believe that we come out of this differently, better. I feel like there are too many angry young people of all races, persuasions, political frames of mind that are seeing and experiencing the same thing. And it's bad. And nobody should want it to continue.
I'll take differently better. I'd be all right with that. Wesley Morris, he writes on culture for the New York Times, does a podcast for them as well. It's called Still Processing. Check it out. Wesley, it's always so good to talk to you.
I missed you. It's great to talk to you, too. You guys have been doing great work.
Thank you. Very nice of you to say. Take it easy. This final note on the way out today, and I do this not to rain on the labor market parade or to mess up a Friday afternoon, but it's really, really important this not get lost in the shuffle. Heather alluded to it, but number one, pandemic as yet unresolved. Number two, there are deep and visceral protests still happening. And number three, yeah, more than 2 million jobs came back last month, but as Heather said, that is 10% of the jobs that we lost in this economy in April. All right. We're leaving, but here's your moment of economic context to end the week. It's pretty quick. Just take care of yourself. That's it. This economy is us. So stay safe out there, would you? Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you on Monday. Everybody stay safe out there, okay? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.